We have far more visitors this morning than I can acknowledge, but I look out to see Joy Walker's son Johnny and Larry and Vicki Culver back home from Seattle. Wonderful to see them. And now, Toby and Laura Harrison, I'm going to give you a choice. If you wish to give me a profile later, I will spare you what I'm about to ask you to do next. But you must either give me a profile a little later so people can read about you. Toby and Laura were members of this church, moved away, moved back. If there's to be no profile, you have to stand up now and turn and face everybody. Which do you pick? Toby doesn't want to do a profile, does he? Here he is. Come on. Hey, wait a minute. I want Casey and Alyssa and Amber and April to stand up also. These are the other members of the family. They occupy a whole front row. Okay. I knew he wouldn't do a profile. He's a beloved friend, but an incredibly stubborn one. Give me up there just the tiniest bit more juice, please, sir. Now, for the benefit of our visitors who do not receive the church newsletter, I need to explain what is happening in the pulpit this morning. Like most ministers who wonder how to approach the beauty of Christmas in some fresh and creative way, I woke up in the middle of the night several weeks ago and thought of how much harder it would be this year than usual, since we would already have had, as we did last Sunday, an hour of glorious orchestral and choral music. How this service would be the time for the conventional Christmas sermon, and how tonight would bring us still two more celebrations of Christmas Eve, one at 7 and one at 11, a quirk of this year's calendar that will make this Sunday the longest day of the year for churches all over the country. So I decided to try something I had never done before, to ask you to preach the sermon this morning by sharing your own happiest or most poignant Christmas memories with me, especially the ones that go back to a time very, very different from 1995. You responded so generously that I got more than I could use, but you anticipated that dilemma and gave me permission to edit and to save some for another time. I might tell you that part of what was on my mind, wondering what to say that was fresh, was the realization that I would be looking straight back into the face of Sue Spriggs, who has heard me do these Christmas sermons for 35 years, and that behind me would be a choir member who started hearing them soon after the end of the Civil War. New ways of life come with such bewildering speed nowadays that it can be hard to imagine what the world was like in the childhood of many in this church. Ivan and Donna West gave me a clever way of illustrating that when they shared some recollections from the 50th wedding anniversary of Donna's sister. The husband and wife that day were reminded of how it was when they first fell in love, when there was no television. Can you imagine that? No frozen dinners, no credit cards. Back when a chip meant a piece of wood. Hardware meant things made of metal, and software wasn't even a word. A time when grass was something you mowed. Coke was something you drank, and pot was something you cooked in. A time when 5 cents would buy a stamp for one letter and 2 postcards. When a new Chevrolet coupe cost $695 and the gas for it was 11 cents a gallon. Somewhere in that lost world, most of this morning's Christmas memories are located. Lois Kant takes us back 57 years to another country where the most terrible event of the 20th century was beginning to take shape. Right after they were married, she and husband Bill, an exchange student from KU, lived in the university town of Tübingen, Germany, from the summer of 1938 to the summer of 1939. Hitler had been in power for about 5 years and was already plotting the conquest of Europe. 2 months after Bill and Lois arrived, they happened to be in Munich when England and France gave Hitler the richest parts of Czechoslovakia in the vain hope of avoiding war. On the day of their visit to Munich, they saw Hitler several times as he was driven past where they stood, little dreaming that a year later he would start the most tragic war in history by invading Poland. They remember the night when Hitler's thugs rampaged through cities, smashing the windows of Jewish shop owners, a night called, because of all the shattered glass, Kristallnacht. The two young Americans visited that night a burned-out synagogue where one German man, saddened by the unleashed hatred, asked quietly if they were foreigners and then told them how ashamed he was of his country. 6 weeks later, Bill and Lois decided on Christmas Eve to attend Vespers at a beautiful old church. To their surprise, since religion was discouraged by the Nazis, they found the church filled with worshipers singing the familiar carols that originated in Germany, like Stille Nacht, Silent Night. They left the church that evening, Lois remembers, to the most beautiful snow she had ever seen. Huge, gentle flakes falling softly out of a windless sky. In less than a year, World War II would begin to tear the world apart, but on that holy night, she says, we who would soon be enemies were together in peace to celebrate the birth of the Christ child. Jane Gilchrist remembers a similar Christmas when impending tragedy made a moment of love unforgettable. Despite experimental therapies and a hurried trip to Houston, her beloved father's losing battle with a terminal illness had cast a deep, cold shadow over a home always filled before with song and laughter and cherished traditions, a home where his energy and spirit had always been at the very heart of the Christmas celebrations. With her father so weak, it was hard for him to walk. Jane woke early on that Christmas morning to do the things he had done every year of her life: light the trees, make coffee, turn on Christmas music, build a fire in the living room. I was surprised to hear someone else up early, she writes, and when I reached the bottom stair, I saw my father. Music was playing already. The aroma of coffee was in the air. The tree lights glistened, and he was very slowly and carefully carrying one small log at a time from the woodpile to the living room so a Christmas fire would greet his family as it always had. I was overcome to think of the strength he had summoned up, the effort it had taken to build that roaring fire one tiny log at a time, one last time. I have remembered that morning and my father's embrace every day of my life since, and how I learned that day that the wonder and grace of Christmas can be taken to heart forever, even in the midst of life's most painful challenge. To this day, when I build the Christmas morning fire, I feel surrounded and comforted by my father's great love and generous spirit. It was not the Christmas spirit, but a Santa too familiar with Christmas spirits that gave Mary Ann Ranney a surprise as a small child back in 1922. My mother, brother, and I came home from a Christmas program to find that Santa had come while we were gone and had left our presents. He must have been very quiet since our father, who had stayed home that evening, had apparently not seen him. Both our parents encouraged us to open our gifts and play with them, probably in the hope that we might sleep late the next morning. We were still playing with them when there was a knock at the door, and there stood a Santa we could see with a bag full of even more toys. There was only one problem. They had on them the names of a boy named Tom and a girl named June, and nobody with those names lived at our house. It all happened too long ago for Mary Ann to be sure, but she now thinks that this Santa must have had a few too many spiked eggnogs before heading out for somebody's house, and that Dr. Ranney quickly ushered him out before childhood faith was destroyed. She hopes the convivial and confused Santa found the real Tom and June before the night was over. When we are children, Christmas means toys, so the memories you shared with me were often about the ones you got or didn't get. Or, as in this next poignant story, you got and then lost in a very odd sort of way. Joy Walker remembers the Christmas of 1934 when at age 5 she was living on a Dust Bowl dirt farm in West Texas. "We were poor," she writes. "I mean, really poor. In fact, everyone was poor, so we didn't notice that it was not possible to get any kind of a Christmas present. But on this particular Christmas, my rich uncle, who married very well," I continue to hope that for my bachelor son, "brought my brother and me a sack of marbles each and a real toy truck with battery-operated lights. After playing with these marvelous things for 2 glorious days, we became afraid that someone would steal them. So we buried them." All of them. That was 62 years ago, and we still haven't found them. I think it's almost impossible for a young middle-class family to realize that what they take for granted now would have made them seem wealthy 50 or 60 years ago. Our church secretary, Kathy Penny, told me of Christmas memories she shared that were shared with her by a beloved grandmother who died early this year at 99. When the grandmother was a girl on an Iowa farm with 2 brothers and 2 sisters, her parents could not afford a tree and very little in the way of presents. Instead, the dining room chairs were placed in a row, one for each child, and during the night, Santa would bring each child an orange, a few pieces of peppermint candy, and one small gift. During the year, each girl had a single doll to play with, sewn and stuffed by their mother, who attached a store-bought china head to make it realistic. Since the heads rarely lasted through a year's play, the Christmas gift for each girl was usually a new china doll's head. When I was young, Kathy says, I used to feel sorry for those children who received so little, but my grandmother told me they were just as thrilled on Christmas Day with those gifts as we were with all our store-bought presents. She wanted us to know that what is important at Christmas is not how many gifts we get, but the sharing of love and the celebration of family. When she thought I was old enough to appreciate her doll, she passed it on to me. And this cherished gift sits on a shelf at my home to remind me every year of what really counts, not just at Christmas, but all year long. Cindy Rainey learned one Christmas about a lifestyle even bleaker than that. She remembers a typical holiday dinner when her extended family emptied their stockings, looked at gifts from Santa, and spent a good part of the day opening the gifts they had given one another. That day, as a kind of conversation starter, she said, we had each person at the table tell about a fond childhood memory of Christmas. We heard about the excitement of sleds and bikes and dolls until it came my mother-in-law's turn to speak. A child of Swedish immigrant parents, she had grown up on a farm during the Depression with 8 brothers and sisters. They worked hard just to have food and clothing, and the children understood that times were simply too tough to celebrate Christmas with an exchange of gifts. But there was one Christmas day out of all those bleak years when an uncle came from somewhere to visit and brought a gift that made that day stand alone as something special in her memory. He gave her a piece of candy. Bob Scott's memories are of a childhood Christmas during World War II on the Western Prairie farm his parents had bought a couple of years earlier for $5 an acre. He says, my brother and I had undoubtedly rummaged among the packages under the skinny Christmas tree. Maybe that's why he chose when he grew up to have so many big fat Christmas trees. And had squeezed a few of them to help with the guessing game. And we could hardly wait for Christmas Eve with grandparents and cousins coming to join our family of 4. I can see Mom busy at work in the kitchen and Dad asleep in his chair. I can hear Paul Harvey on the radio reporting news of the war. And I can smell the coal smoke from the troop trains rolling down the valley near our house on the Missouri Pacific Railroad. Gene Autry was singing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and life was rich. Now it's 1995, and the troop trains are long since gone. The coal has given way to diesel, and the family of 4 has become a family of 16. As soon as our Christmas Eve service is over at UCC, we'll head west to that same prairie farm where things will not have changed. Mom busy again in the kitchen, Dad asleep again in his chair, Paul Harvey on the radio, and life still good. Marilyn Ritchie also responded to my request for a memory of Christmas past, and I can't imagine a better way to show the younger half of this congregation how the world has changed than to tell this brief story. When Marilyn was born in 1931, this country was a couple of years already into the Great Depression. And since there were already four hungry boys in that family, she thinks it was probably a good thing she was the little girl at last. Otherwise, they might not have kept her. The truth is, of course, that both her parents and her brothers lavished on her the kind of love that made her grow up confident and happy, but the hard times certainly kept them from spoiling her with material things. When she was about six, the Christmas present she asked for, because you got only one, was a pair of ice skates. Her parents said, "Marilyn, we can't afford ice skates. You need to think of something else." But her brother, Royal, who was here last week for the concert he and Marilyn sponsored in memory of their mother, found out about her disappointment and handled it in a way she would never forget. He was a student at Iowa State at the time, and he skipped lunch every day for a month to save money for a pair of ice skates for his baby sister. That kind of love, Marilyn came to realize, is the best thing about any Christmas. I was surprised at my own earliest Christmas memory when I went back through the years in search of it. Not my favorite, but the very first connection I can make with Christmas. An odd one. But then that won't surprise you, I suppose. When I go back as far as I can to find an image of that holiday, I see a small boy sitting at a table, first drawing and then coloring fireplaces on pages of Big Chief notebook paper, over and over trying to make them look like pictures I had seen in magazines. We didn't have a fireplace, and I realized without any surprise or jealousy that only rich people had fireplaces where children hung deep, fat stockings to be stuffed by Santa. And I suppose that must be why I created them on paper, deep red bricks with dark oak mantles and two huge, hungry stockings for my sister and myself, trying to provide what my hardworking father could not manage. I was very proud of my crayoned fireplace pictures, and I think my mother and father must have told me they were good, which is how parents build confidence in children before they discover on their own, as I did, that perhaps they should think of doing something else in life. The second memory from two or three years later is at least a little less self-centered. I had learned from someone how to make a toy boat by folding a piece of paper about 15 times. They're fairly complicated for a child, and I was immensely pleased when I learned how to make them and float them in the bathtub. I took a sheet of typing paper before I left home this morning and made all the folds but the last one, so that the boat actually looks like this, just before the final revelation. Then when you do at last open it up, if I got it right, no, wrong side up, it comes out like this, and you catch it underneath and open it up so it has a mast. You see what a nice little boat it makes? And then you can write something on the other side of it, like this, which says the USS Casey. And if you didn't get anything else for Christmas, Casey, this is yours. Okay? Now, it struck me one Christmas when I must have been seven that it would be nice to give these presents to every kid in the neighborhood. Now, this really was depression time, so I made about 20 of them. And early on Christmas Eve, my sister and I put them inside the screen doors of the houses in our neighborhood where we knew there were children. We weren't sophisticated enough to think they might laugh at such a simple gift. It made us feel generous and good. And frankly, my guess is that the naive idealism of that impulse may have been the purest kind of unselfishness either of us would ever know. Now I will tell you how the blessings of my Christmas Eve and Christmas tomorrow have been put in perspective by a couple of conversations I had this week. A young man who is not a member of this church, but who always loved coming here on Christmas Eve, is so near death from AIDS that he has constant care 24 hours a day, but he has insisted that his mother and grandmother come on to our late service tonight, just as they have done for many, many years. When I talked with him on Thursday night, his thoughts were not on some Christmas in the past, as ours have been, but on the Christmas coming Monday, tomorrow, which he would prefer with all his heart not to see. His suffering has become intolerable, and his deepest wish, he has told his mother and me, is that while we celebrate tonight the birth of one child, God might grant the gift another child wants and call him into eternal peace. So I have a favor to ask. In the midst of your holiday happiness, in some quiet place, remember James. God bless all of you. Amen.